Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing? Hope you are doing well. My name is Andrew Kuhn with Focus Compounding, on air live with Jeff Gannon. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Andrew. How's it going with you?
It's going great. We hope it's going great with everybody else as well. If this is the first time you are tuning in with us, thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to go to our website, focuscompounding.com, to get access to investment write-ups from Jeff going all the way back to 2005. If you're interested in learning about our money management services, you can reach out to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com. And of course, be sure to follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter, to get access to everything that we push out into the investing universe. Look at this. I'm on quickfs.net. If you're watching the screen, you can see this. One of the first 8 things to look at when researching a stock, he's got a quote from you, Jeff Gannon, Focused Compounding. Do you still use QuickFS a lot, Jeff?
I use QuickFS all the time.
Is it your homepage?
QuickFS, SEC, Edgar, and OTC Markets are all home tabs or, you know, start tabs for me.
There you go. Spoken like a true stock market junkie. So today's podcast, Jeff, we're going to talk about oil companies, specifically which sector, or I guess you could say, part of the oil industry you're most interested in. Buffett's obviously been buying Occidental Petroleum, still buying Occidental Petroleum. Also, I believe, does he still own Chevron, Jeff? Is that correct?
Yes. And I think he still bought owns some Chevron. More. Yeah, I can check the exact things. Yeah. So Occidental, Chevron are the two that he owns. Yeah.
So let's talk about, you know, oil in general, investing in oil companies, what you look for. There's all these different metrics, PV10, and different things like that. Looking at the reserves that a company has, there's a lot of different buzzwords in the oil industry. So let's talk a little bit about it, see what your thoughts are on oil companies, what you typically look for, and go from there. So is there a certain part of the oil industry that you like investing in? I mean, is there a part that you tend to stay away from? What are your thoughts on it?
Sure. So we only own, oil and natural gas and some related things. But mostly we own things in the United States that are 100% US. We own some stuff that isn't 100% US, but was originally US and then, you know, owns other things now. So I don't have, you know, if you look, you're going to find lots of things that are from around the world, right? And you're going to find lots of things that are offshore, and we don't have stuff that is historically either of those. You mentioned Occidental and Chevron. Buffett added to both of them last quarter. I just checked. He owns about $18 billion of Occidental, $15 billion of Chevron, or something in that neighborhood. Depends on where the prices are, right? So he's also big on the same sorts of things. Those companies are pretty big in oil specifically. And the one he likes better is Occidental, obviously. Because he also owns warrants in that, which I'm not counting when I tell you how much he owns of it.
Okay. And what is it about, you think, Occidental and Chevron that he likes? Is it just the size of it and they just do everything? So it's sort of just a bet on higher oil prices and oil demand going forward. Why do you think he chose these two companies?
I mean, my honest suspicion is that he wants, what he would like to own is a company that's 100% oil in the United States and has capital allocation that he likes, but no such companies of size exist, right? He has to own things that are oil and other stuff. There's no just oil. And he has to own things that are exposed to things outside the United States, and he can't control the company, so he doesn't get the capital allocation that he wants, right? But these are the closest to what he wants. But yes, my guess is, from what he says always, what he wants is long-term exposure to the commodity of oil, right? But he can't get that.
So speaking of Buffett, I forgot to mention this in the intro. You are going to be in Omaha this year for the Berkshire meeting. Yes. So if anyone wants to meet up with you, talk investing, talk about investing in our fund, everything that we're doing, you can reach out to me at andrew@focuscompounding.com. Forgot to insert that in the beginning. We have invested in oil companies, and it's a different type of company than like an Occidental Petroleum. Do you want to talk about that and why you like that version more than like an Occidental, or was it just a price thing?
No, it's just size and price. I mean, I think we actually own things that are probably a lot like Occidental, probably. I mean, that's the wrong way of saying it. Occidental is the one of the biggest things that are similar to stuff that we own, I guess, is my feeling. The questions that people asked are like, how do you value oil companies and all that? The issues are, it depends on where the oil is in the world and in the country, right? So they do things about comparing pricing, all that. They ask about the cost per barrel and these emails. It's difficult because that's the cost that you're getting wherever the oil is, which may not be that related to once you have the differential in terms of transit and all that might be different. And then you have where it is, right? So that's a big part of why I think Buffett owns the things that he does, is because he wants to be in certain parts of the country where he thinks that it's good to, certain plays, right? So I think that that's when people ask about and stuff, that's really what he wants. The companies, I think, specifically are because of the people running it.
Mm-hmm. Are there some countries that you would stay away from? I mean, do you just, yeah, would like you typically stay? Yeah, I was going to say, are there all of them outside of the United States? I mean, would it be like a Venezuelan Venezuela? Would you invest in a company that had a bunch of oil reserves there? Or is it more so you want to stick to the United States?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not against owning oil things in other countries. You know, we talked about a company one time that was built. There was a company, I think it calls itself ATNI now, but it was called Atlantic Telenetworks. And it had a long distance monopoly in basically Central America in one small country. And it was a tiny microcap stock, maybe a nanocap at that time. And it built out from that. People we always traded at like, you know, 2-3 times EBITDA or something when like telecom things at the time were trading at 10. And it's because everyone always thought, well, they'll just vote that out. They'll take that monopoly away from them, right? Didn't happen. And then it bought a lot of things in all other Caribbean islands and things all around the Americas. And so it turned into a different company. So there's nothing wrong with having a very cheap stock that's getting all of it from another country. I just don't think it's unique to oil. Like there was a stock that people were very positive on and asking me about all the time that was a Russian media stock, right? The company was actually structured so the corporately was in the US and stuff. It was better structured than like these Chinese stocks that Americans can buy and stuff, where you're actually, this was much better legally and everything. But, you know, Putin could just take the asset anytime that he wanted, right? And this was many years ago. Now people wouldn't do that. And it tried to be non-political and stuff. So it was always selling itself to investors like, look, there's no political reason for it or whatever. But I feel about oil the way that I do about things like media stuff. I think that sometimes they're not protected from the government in the same way as other things. In the United States, I think that they are because the law is here. So the big thing is that mineral rights in the United States, right, belong to the landowner. They're private and they don't belong to the government. So if a government has minerals in the United States, it's because they actually own the land, right? So it's like in a national park or something. Otherwise, I bought a house, right? There's a thing listed there for appraised value of the mineral rights as part of the things that they're taxing. I can see oil, in the area, right? So obviously, that changes completely the economics and the political situation and stuff. And that's why you had fracking here and all of that in certain places, because someone can just say, I want to pay you royalties and stuff. So there's a whole industry built around and stuff in the United States, and I'd be more worried in other countries about that, right? But what I'm saying is, if you can find it trading for less in another country and everything, then that's great. And then they can use it and allocate it to other things. So I have no problem with that. If you could find an oil company at 1-2 times EBITDA in some West African country, that's going to take that and then invest it somewhere else in the world and everything, that's great. Because you just put a probability of what's the risk to it and everything, and if it has enough of a discount rate to it. The reason why I think Buffett buys U.S. things now and why we have is because I don't think that they trade at a big premium over things that are riskier.
If you're going to own an oil company full cycle, is there certain things that, from like a financial perspective, that you want to look for, right? So probably not having so much leverage, I imagine, because when the tide goes out or maybe oil takes a step back. I mean, go back to 2020 when, remember, the price of oil futures went negative, right? And what that did to the entire industry. I mean, things like that happen. I mean, it's a very volatile asset. So is there anything in particular that you want to look for, certain attributes in an oil company, if you do want to own it full cycle? I mean, do you think about owning these things full cycle? Is it more so just trying to time the cycle? How do you typically think about that?
Yeah, so stuff we own is very, very low debt. When you, you know, weight it for how much we own of everything, right? So if you like combined it into one oil company, it would have almost no debt. Yeah, it has way less debt of all the things we own compared to other oil companies. I think that that's largely accidental, though, because I think that the reason companies have debt right now is not that they chose to have the debt, but what they did in the past, right? And I'm not necessarily opposed to debt. In fact, even in situations where they have some debt, it's because the capital allocation of the company changed, and I liked it better after it changed. But I wouldn't have bought the company before, which was the when they put on the debt, right? So I think that debt in the oil industry right now is usually an indicator of what their capital allocation was 10 years ago or something, and not so much now, because no one's had very high capital spending on stuff. So it's not financial engineering in most of these cases. They took on a lot of debt to acquire things and stuff.
Mm-hmm. What about energy service companies? Is there anything in that particular pocket of the market that you like?
No, we talked about an energy services related stock, not an energy services stock, but a stock that distributed things. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So remember, what was the ticker? Was KLXI, KLX, remember, as a roll up. It still exists, right? It didn't go into bankruptcy. It was going to, but it didn't, right? So it's virtually worthless compared to when it was spun off, right?
Because I remember the whole pitch when this was being spun off was it had no debt. Mm-hmm. It was going to be at like 5 or 6 times EBITDA. I mean, very low valuation. Management was going to own a lot. It sort of had that perfect Joel Greenblatt skin in the game and like the quintessential spinoff that you'd like to invest in. And it was not, I don't think it's worked out well.
No, I think it's lost almost all of its value. It if things hadn't changed, I think it was going to go bankrupt. I watched it when it was close to what I expected it to be in bankruptcy, and it didn't end up that way. Let's see. Oh, it must have reverse split or something. Yeah, they so did. Is it down 90% or something? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like 99.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that happened to some other spinoffs, right? There was, you know, that's not unique. There's other situations that were like this, which, so I don't want to make it sound like there's just oil related stocks that bad. Look, we haven't done anything with things that don't own assets of actual, well, we haven't owned things that don't have the economic rights to profit from actual reserves of oil and natural gas pretty much indefinitely. Okay. So it's a little bit more complicated than that legally, because sometimes you might own things which are not actually the same as owning or operating something, but basically our exposure through all this stuff and the thing that we analyze them on is as an owner. In some cases, that's all that they are, that they own something, they don't operate it. In other cases, they are more like a economic partner in something in which they're collecting earnings more in line with more realistically what the operator is earning, as opposed to owning something where you can make money to some extent on a royalty on it, even if it's not really profitable for the person extracting the oil or the natural gas. Of course, they'll stop doing it at some point if it's not, and you'll stop earning the royalties. But basically what we're talking about is that you're owning it as property, is like from an economic perspective is what we are analyzing all of these on. And we don't have any ownership of any energy stuff that's unrelated to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you typically look for, though? So we talked about having oil in the United States, capital allocation, which, as we've spoken a lot on this podcast, has changed over the years in these oil companies. What else? I mean, is there something that catches your eye? I mean, how do you typically go about analyzing these? I mean, do you look at those metrics like PV10 and all that, all sorts of other stuff? Maybe take us through that.
Yeah. So the most important thing to start with what we just talked about is there's PV10, which is in the SEC filing for all the US companies that have, where it's very important what the value of their oil and natural gas is. There's some companies that have oil and natural gas, but they don't have to do it because the business does lots of other stuff, and it doesn't pass some test that requires it. But generally, anyone that you'd be looking at for that reason, you can see that there's something at the back of the SEC filing, which is very complicated. It's an extremely complicated and confusing thing because it involves assumptions that are confusing to investors. So it is a discounted cash flow analysis, basically. It's the results of a DCF, which are using prices for the future, which are based on the average of the past 12 months' prices for a commodity, let's say oil. And then it takes, what was it, in January, February, March, et cetera. It adds them all together, divides by 12. That's your average, right? Which may be very different from the price at the time that you're reading it, because the report itself is probably 3 months out of date almost or something. And then even at the time that it's the period end for. So you could be reading something that is including prices for January as 1/12 of it, and it's 15 months later. And so it could be including prices that oil could have been going up a lot, going down a lot, right? And then it's using these prices for future years that it's showing you based on the company's assumptions and stuff. And that's obviously inaccurate if you're living in a world with inflation, deflation, whatever. And then also, because it's not adjusted for inflation, you also have the issue of the discount rate. And the discount rate used for it is standardized at 10%. So as a result, what I would say and what you can see from Buffett doing it is that while I think some people use the PV10 calculation there as if it's something like book value or something like that, it's actually pretty conservative. It also is, which they'll break down for you there, you've got your reserves that are proved, reserves that are already developed that you have that are producing, you know. So you have whether the reserves are proven or probable and whether they're producing or not. Right. And so for some companies, it's going to make a huge difference of stuff that isn't included in there. And for other companies, it's not. So I would use it very similar to how you would use book value. Tangible book value and PV10, I think, have a lot in common in that I think they're not helpful in many cases if we just use them randomly across all companies and applied it. What it really matters is how realistic are these numbers versus the future, and what is the capital allocation of the company going to be? If you get a really cheap stock on tangible book and you're living in a world with a lot of inflation, a world where you think that the past prices that a company paid for something are really low compared to what you could reproduce them for in the future, and you have an owner who's committed to like liquidating and to changing and to doing better things with it, then it's very exciting. So even if it's a bad company, even if it's Berkshire Hathaway when Buffett takes over, that's a world with some inflation and stuff. You start to have a lot of inflation after 65, and that's about when he takes over. And it's a world where he's going to liquidate the inventory and stuff and then buy other things with it and turn it around. I think PV10 is similar to that, because an issue that you have always, whether we're looking at banks or oil companies or something that I don't like as much, is you get like your value investors write up, right? And they spend all this time showing me the composition of the loan book, you know, that what is the, where are they getting the oil from and stuff? Where are they getting the natural gas from? But then you look at some of these and it's like, okay, but let's look at the decline curve and stuff. It's basically, in some of these cases with natural gas, okay, you're just telling me what it's going to look like as this changes over the next 5 years. But what the company will be in year six has got to be very different from what it looks like now, because these reserves are just going to turn to cash pretty fast. You know, when we compare this to U.S. lime or something, some of the reserve life of this stuff is pretty short for oil companies and things. There's some in the world that that's not true. But generally, compared to some other commodities, mines and things, it's pretty short. So whatever you think you're getting today, in 5 or 10 years, they're going to buy a portfolio of things that is different from it. The exact wells and things that they own now aren't going to last that long. So, and we talked about that when we did like how these companies have lasted so long, that were the Standard Oil companies and everything. Yes, but they don't own any of the same locations, basically, that they were in the beginning. right? The company started out being really big. Literally, some of these companies started out being big in Pennsylvania and California and Texas and stuff. That's not their, I mean, main places that they're getting it today. Then they went all over the world getting it and in different places in the United States that they never got from back then at all.
When you look at a company like Chevron, right? So $291 billion market cap, $302 billion enterprise value, 14 times earnings, 15 times EV to free cash flow. What do you think Buffett's looking at in a company like this? I mean, return on equity is higher than asset growth.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we have to look at the right-hand side there, right? Return on invested capital, because I think that's very important for all companies that we're going to talk about here and to understand the cyclicality of it, right? So that graph is going back, what, 20 years for Chevron?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Back to 2001.
Okay. Yeah. So you can see the importance of the oil prices. I remember the late 90s, early 2000s, because my age and stuff. So I remember how incredibly cheap gas was, gasoline, you know, so how, what oil prices were like back then. So at the time of the dot-com boom and stuff, you had very low prices, right? And then I'm sure many more people remember the high prices that you had that topped out at almost the exact same moment the financial crisis hit, right? We got very high prices. I don't know if we got to 140 on Brent or something, but we got real high for a brief moment. We certainly were over 100 for a while. And then you can see things since then, and people can see there COVID, right? That you remember. So you can see the extremes there and how tied it is to oil prices, right? And then you have here a very difficult to understand quick FS. I think it's hard to see for any oil companies except the biggest, most diversified ones. I think we looked at Exxon one time, and that's a good example of something that people could look at and think that you could evaluate using quick FS. That, you know, I don't think that the past results of the company and stuff are realistically relevant. Because of what you just said, like, okay, what does the company have now that it also had 20 years ago? What does it have that also had 15, 10, whatever? I mean, what I like about quick FS and doing this for companies is things that are very similar over long periods of time, right? And when we look at Cinemark on that, right, it operates the same sorts of things, doing the same stuff. The industry doesn't change that much each year, and we can compare it and say, okay, this is getting a certain percentage of the box office year after year. All these other companies, that's not true. There's no similarity to it. They don't control a certain portion of the United States industry in terms of having distribution or whatever. It's not like they have similar market share from year to year. So these are purely just things that are assets that I don't know that ever looking in the rearview mirror like that is helpful, except to understand cap allocation if the same management team and stuff is still in place. But then a lot of times the best time is when it's not. So I think it's all about the future projections and not at all about looking at the past, to me. In fact, I think what worries me is when people start to think of them as blue chip or whatever, like we said with Exxon. Exxon got popular that way and was thought of as better than others and everything. And then it actually re-rated much the other way, and we talked about it on a podcast, and since then it's improved a lot from that, but it had a very bad performance as a stock for a while, I think just because it was kind of expensive and treated as deserving a big premium as compared to other companies.
For capital allocation, is it just buying back stock? Is that what you typically like to see? Is it paying a dividend? I mean, we do own a stock. You've written about it. I mean, VTS, right? A 10% dividend yield and discount to PV10, make the spinoff a cheap speculation on oil. I mean, is there one or the other that
right.
you prefer?
When was that written, though?
April 6th, about a year ago, a little more than a year ago.
Yeah. Okay. So over a year ago. So I just want to be clear, when I said that about cheap whatever thing, you'd have to check what the price of the stock was a year ago. And it's also paid dividends since then. So, you know, also keep that in mind. That's not me saying that it's a cheap speculation on oil today. It's me saying that in April of last year. Because I don't think the dividend yield is that anymore, right? The stock is, I don't know, it's quite a bit higher than it was. Look, in that case, that's a special case. There's some other ones that are special cases. I think I mentioned CNX. That's one that I would recommend for everyone. Gas. That's one I would recommend for everyone because it has a very different strategy. You have the So the chairman, he's a director of the company that we talked about, who wrote a book on capital allocation and everything. And you also have a company that hedges, and we haven't talked about hedging, hedges aggressively or heavily, and then has strategies about buying back stock and stuff. I worry about pro-cyclical behavior, right? So this is the big thing when people ask about capital allocation for lots of industries. The thing is, it often doesn't matter how much people say the capital spending is at a company or something, as if that's the behavior of management, because you can predict those things. You can sort of model it out for the industry. And what you'll see is surprising that, like, they all, whatever they are telling you about, we spend a lot on capital or we don't spend a lot or whatever, you look and you're like, well, actually, companies, once they start spending on capital spending at a certain level, and I can see it, or start paying a regular dividend, these things don't move much. Like I was saying, if you model, put it in Excel and look for a statistical analysis of it, you can, I mean, it fits nicely to for company after company after company. There's not a lot of dots that are way out there that aren't on a line that you would expect. There is for things like special dividends and buybacks and for M&A, big acquisitions. So the problem is you want rational capital allocation that radically goes from doing one thing to another, right? So the things that are really smart is to do a big giant acquisition that makes a lot of sense, and then not to do anything for years, and then to do another one like that, or to pay out a big special dividend. It's the same thing we talk about in other industries. The problem is in public markets, you don't get that, or you don't understand it when you see it. Maybe if you know management, you can talk to them, you understand what's happening. Most of these companies don't have big, large shareholders that control a lot of it. They're heavily institutionally owned, which is another problem. And so you, in many cases, do rely on things like we said with Vitesse, which is more like, because it had been a part of Jefferies with this person that was involved with and everything, and they spun out specifically to pay out a dividend. Is it that there's good capital allocation or not? It's more like there's an understanding, we'll see how long it lasts, of exactly how to run it for capital allocation purposes, which eats up much of the capital, which stops them from doing other things. So the company says, management says, we're all about the dividend. They were spun out for that purpose. They own specific things that are, they're non-operating working interests. So they're things that, there are lots of people, there are lots of investors who own them, but they're actually, big giant companies will often tell you, like, this is stuff that they get rid of when they buy something that also has it attached to it and stuff. So it makes them slightly, I would say, more of a poor fit for things. So less likely that they're going to merge with things, be sold to things, buy things, whatever. Doesn't mean they won't do it, but it puts them in a separate kind of category. And so because of all those things I talked about, it means their capital allocation is more likely to be that you could understand what it is, and it's not going to do something that I really don't want them to do. But we could be totally wrong about that. But yes, the structure of what specific things they own and the who the management was, the history of it, because then management's a big, the management got shares in it and stuff. So the management's big in it. And then also people you had from the Leucadia side of Jefferies, also big owners in it, right? So you feel like, okay, you know what they're going to do with this in terms of capital allocation. It's completely true that if it was the same assets, but I didn't feel that way about what they were saying, what they were doing with the dividend, the history of the company, and what they were saying, and then also the stuff that I talked about specifically what they own, but this is not being a good fit for other people. I don't think that we would be interested in it, right? There's many cases where we're interested in the assets, very interested, but stock markets are not places where you get to buy the underlying assets. You're not allowed to do that. It would be great if we could buy and say, okay, send me my 3% of your company's oil reserves. Thank you. If we could do that, same with gold things or whatever, then we would do it. There's often prices where the oil or the gold or whatever in the ground sells for an attractive price, but you're buying it through the company. So CNX is one that I would say everyone should look at in terms of if you want something that's wildly different capital allocation. My biggest problem with oil things, even in the United States, where there's tons of these companies, is I can only come up with handfuls of them that have radically unusual capital allocation, right? So giving the Berkshire comparison, Berkshire took a, you know, Buffett took over textile mill, changed the capital allocation completely. He compared it at one time to, was it Burlington Industries? The company that was also the other big textile company at the same time. I think he looked at what they did over the 20 years that Berkshire owned the mills and then closed down the mills. He once compared it to another textile company, which would have been comparable to Berkshire, but then reinvested all in textiles. there's like 10, 20, 100 energy companies that look like that company and one that looks like Berkshire. You know what I mean? You don't have a lot of wildly different capital allocation. But, you know, there's probably hundreds of U.S. banks that all have the same, right, dividend payouts and the same kind of capital allocation. There's not that many that are really different. So, so I'd focus, like we said, on the cheapness on the PV10 and all of that, sure. So lots of reserves that aren't included in the PV10, and then also a low price versus the PV10. And then I would look for cap allocation over the things that you want to see happen, which could be dividends, could be buybacks, could be all sorts of different things. And then we didn't get into the hedging, but a lot of companies hedge. But a lot of times I don't think it matters. CNX is different, but my argument with the hedging is it doesn't matter that much. It matters to the bankers. I would want someone to be hedging if I was making a loan to them. And it matters maybe for consistency of the dividend and not making things look bad. But mainly what it helps do is smooth earnings. But they're not hedging enough far enough into the future for it to usually make a radical difference in your decision about buying the company. Like you're not going to find cases where you're buying a company that has 100% of its production hedged for 10 years or something, which would radically change what you'd be willing to pay for a company. What you're going to see is that they have 30, 40, 50% of the production on average hedged for the next 6 to 18 months or something, which just means that as those things roll off, they're going to hedge again part of it in the future at different prices, but the new prices they get on new hedges are going to be related to the prices of oil at that future time. So that's a lot like being heavily exposed to the future prices of the commodity anyway. So I think it confuses the financial statements and makes it look smoother than it really is. It's most of your value in the stock is not usually hedged enough for it to matter. In stocks, you're very heavily exposed to future cash flows way out into the future, and those aren't being hedged.
Cool. Well, I want to thank everybody so much for tuning in with the both of us on the Focused Compounding Podcast. If you want to have a question or topic, have us go over it on the podcast, you can email it to me at andrew@focusedcompounding.com. If you're going to Omaha and would like to meet up with Jeff to learn about what we're doing with Focused Compounding or just talk about investing, reach out to me at andrew@focusedcompounding.com. I want to thank everybody so much for all the support. Be sure to hit the subscribe button, and we will see you in the next podcast. Take care.